You can turn to Judges chapter 9 tonight. We're going to look at just one chapter. It's a fairly long one. On Thursdays, we're working our way through this Old Testament book that showcases God's enduring mercy in the midst of a series of tragic tales and stories. And when we get to Judges 9, we've looked at quite a few judges so far. We've looked at Othniel and Ehud and Gideon and Deborah and a few of those that are more obscure. And we're, in a sense, at the halfway point, and you could consider this chapter an intermission, in a sense. There's no judge that's talked about in this chapter. It's a space of time in between judges. It is about an individual. It's about a guy named Abimelech. He's not a judge. He is a king, but he's not a king over all of Israel. He's a king over one little small region, and he's basically a self-appointed king. So you could consider him almost a false king, not even really a true king. And when you look at this chapter, you might be wondering, why is it in the book? Because you could take it out, and you just have another series and sequence of judges. So why did God put this chapter right here in the middle? It's a departure from the normal flow. There's no formal enemy, there's no foreign enemy, and there's no judge to save. In some sense, this chapter is an addendum to verse 35 of Judges 8, where it says that the children of Israel did not show kindness to the house of Jerubbabel, that is Gideon, in accordance with the good that he had done for Israel. So Gideon had passed away. He had 70 sons. And it says Israel didn't show kindness to them. But chapter 8 doesn't explain what Israel did. Chapter 9 does. So that's part of it. I think another part of this chapter and why it's in here is it portrays the restlessness that's in Israel even when there's no outside oppressor. At this point in their history, they've been having peace when God brings in a deliverer. And yet after Gideon, the word peace isn't used. And there's this restlessness because they're not really resting in the Lord. So this is a bizarre story. It's about a son. It's about Abimelech and a city. And their intertwined ambition and both of them, their ultimate ruin. And I'd like to begin by just using an illustration. So how many of you guys have watched the Pixar movie, The Incredibles? Okay, if you haven't, you've got to watch it. It's one of my favorite Pixar movies, outside of Up. I think that is my favorite. But this one's good also. So there's a guy who is a wannabe hero in the story, right? Do you remember what his name is? Buddy. Buddy Pine, right? He has a nickname that he's called himself. He's this little boy who's hanging around with Bob and Mr. Incredible. And Bob keeps telling him, go home, you know, right? And he says, I'm Incrediboy, right? And inside this little boy, what is there? I think there's a longing for greatness. There's a longing to be someone, to live out and become a hero. And he sees these other people who are heroes. He sees Mr. Incredible and these others, and he wants to be in the action. And he keeps being told, go home. You know, there's nothing special about you. You don't have any magical powers. And he's getting in the way. And it's interesting because he starts out with these dreams of greatness. Then he experiences rejection that to him is very painful. But then he swallows a pill of bitterness. And he converts. No longer is he pursuing true greatness. No longer is he pursuing heroism. But he becomes a villain. He becomes the very opposite of a hero. He's the arch enemy of Mr. Incredible later on in the movie. And that, in a sense, is a little picture of what we see in this chapter. Because we're not going to look at Incrediboy. We're going to look at Abimelech, who, in one commentary I read, named him Bramble Man. And I wouldn't even use the term man. He is an adult, but he's acting like a boy. And I'd call him Bramble Boy. And how he is living out his life. But I see a lot of parallels between Incrediboy or Buddy Pine and Abimelech. So think of that as we're going through this story. I also want you to think of something that Shakespeare wrote in his play Henry VIII, when Cromwell was hearing something from Wolsey. Shakespeare said this, "I charge thee, fling away ambition. By that sin fell the angels." And I don't think ambition in and of itself is a bad thing, the desire to be great or the desire to do something for God. But when it's wrongly pursued, it turns angels into demons. It turns Abimelech into the bramble boy. And so we see here a man who pursues honor through illegitimate means and ends not in his honor, it ends in his shame. So there's four parts to the chapter. We're going to look at his coronation or his crowning, a cry, cracks in his kingdom, and then the collapse. So verses 1 through 6 here first, the coronation. Verse 1. "And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbabel," that was another name for Gideon, "went to Shechem, to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, Please, speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbabel reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone." And his brothers, or his mother's brothers, spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. And their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our brother." So they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah. And Gideon's passed away at this time, so it's his sons. And it's Abimelech's half-brothers. So Abimelech is a son of Gideon, but he's a son of Gideon's concubine who lived in Shechem. So he had a different mother, and in that sense, he's an outsider. And so he's talked to his mother's family, said, "Talk to the people of your town, Shechemites, and see if they'd be willing to have me be their leader." And they say yes, and so they hire him. He uses the money to hire a bunch of worthless guys, and they go to Ophrah. And with these individuals, he killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbabel, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbabel, was left, because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, and all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. So you have here this man's coronation, and you have a bloody mess prior to the coronation, prior to his crowning. So a little bit of background on Abimelech, and then also in the city of Shechem. So as I mentioned, Abimelech was a person who had a shadowed childhood. I'd like to read this from one commentary. "From his birth, he had been an outsider in his own family. Unlike Gideon's other 70 sons, he was illegitimate. He did not stand to inherit. As the story unfolds, we see a man who feels that whatever he will get out of life, he will have to get for himself, and who is utterly determined to get what he can." And in this sense, you look at him and you can have maybe a little tiny bit of pity for him. There's a person who feels like, "I am on the outside, and I long for something in life, and I'm not going to get anything in life because I have just been dealt a bad deck of cards." And so he tries to make the most of what he's got, but he cheats. He doesn't do it God's way. And he goes to his mom's family, and he gets their approval. And when you look at this, you can say it's a factor in his life, but it's not an excuse. I think it's important for us when we look at people who commit different wrongs and sins. There are sometimes factors that lead them down that path. A circumstance in the past that's just soured their life. And it's not an excuse for the actions that they take in the future, but it does maybe help explain a little bit of why they took some of the steps that they did. And here, this man takes some unfortunate, very sad steps. The city of Shechem, they had been a people that had long been living alongside of Israel. That city was around back in Genesis chapter 12 when Abraham gets to the promised land. When he's in this city or at this place, it's when God first tells him, this is the land I'm going to give to you. So they have a long history of being alongside Israel. There's one situation back in their past when there was some bad blood, in a sense, between Israel and Shechem, and that's in Genesis chapter 34, when a guy in that city who was ungodly, not following the Lord, liked an Israelite girl, Jacob's daughter, and he slept with her, and then he wanted to marry her, but he's not a believer. And the brothers were greatly offended that she had been violated, and so they went to the city and they wiped all the men out. And so that's in their past. In Joshua chapter 8 and Joshua chapter 24, we see this is where Israel, in a sense, rededicated themselves to God after they crossed over the promised land. And this city's nestled between two hills, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Does anybody know what happened on these two hills? Blessings and cursings. So when they crossed over, Moses had given instructions, when you get into the land, you're supposed to split, you know, some of the people, and the blessings are supposed to be spoken on Mount Gerizim, the curses on Mount Ebal, and you're to hear these things. These are the consequences if you disobey. These are the blessings if you obey. And so Shechem is connected with all of that. And so Abimelech here, it's his strategy. He wants to be king, but he's a diplomat. And so he goes about it in a way where he gets the people to ask him, will you be our king? And so then he says yes. And you look at the Shechemites, you wonder, why are they wanting to do this? And I think maybe for them it was maybe wanting some degree of maybe security for them as a city. Maybe they thought it would help them if they had a leader or commander like this. But there's this sad crime of murdering all of Gideon's sons. And though Abimelech is an accomplice and the leader in it, the other people are guilty because they do nothing to stop it. And in fact, they fund it. There's one little detail, and then we'll move on, that I think is important. If you look at verse 5, it says, but Jotham, the youngest son of Zerubbabel, was left because he hid himself. And in that little statement, basically it's a loose thread. Abimelech has this big plan. Shechem has a plan. We're going to have this alliance. But there's this one detail that gets missed. And in every ambition that's not consistent with God's kingdom, there's always a loose thread in it. And eventually, it's going to unravel everything that a person is building up. And this loose thread, we're going to see, speaks out in the next verse. So verse 7 through 21. Now when they told it to Jotham, he finds out Abimelech has been crowned king. He went and stood on Mount Gerizim, which is the mountain where the blessings had been pronounced years earlier. And he's not going to speak a blessing here. He's going to speak a warning. And he lifts his voice and he cried out and he said to them, and he shares this parable or this story. Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men and go to sway over the trees? Then the trees said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit to go sway over trees? Then the trees said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine which cheers both God and men, and go to sway over the trees? In other words, they want a king, and the trees go to different trees. They go to the olive tree, they go to the fig tree, and the vine, and they say, will you reign over us? And all of them say, basically, if we do this, we have to leave our calling. We have to leave the produce and the good things that we are doing, both for God and man. So they decline. Verse 14. Then all the trees said to the bramble, or the blackberry, the thorn branch, you come and reign over us. And that's stooping pretty low, right? If you think of all these trees, the cypress and the cedar of Lebanon, and they're coming to a blackberry. It's not even a tree, right? And they say to the bramble, would you reign over us? And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. Is there much shade in a bramble? Dangerous shade if you're laying under a bramble bush. Scary place to be in. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, if you have dealt well with Zerubbabel and his house, and have done to him as he deserves, in a sense, very well. For my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian. But you have risen up against my father's house this day, and killed his 70 sons on one stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Zerubbabel this day, or with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled, and he went to Beer and dwelt there. Now, in English, it looks like it's beer as in alcohol, but I think you pronounce it in Hebrew, bear, so bear. And dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. Okay, so in this section here, we have the cry of Jotham. And he's the speaker. He's the person who confronts what's going on. His name means the Lord is blameless, or the Lord is perfect. And in this entire chapter, God is not mentioned by name. There's no Lord here. But in a subtle way, we see him, in a sense, referenced here with Jotham's name. And the spot is significant because it's a place where blessings had been pronounced. And in these actions, Israel's forfeiting blessings, and they're playing with fire. Now, one question. Why does he tell the story? Why not just confront them and say, you guys are in sin. You guys are playing with fire. Why does he tell this story? Any thoughts? I think there's a few reasons. I think one is he is gaining their attention. And how many people like a good story? Not a bad story, but a good story. It doesn't matter how old you are. You can be 3 years old or you can be 53 years old. And people like a good story. And so here he's sharing a story. He's sharing a parable. It's perking their interest. What's he talking about? But also stories, not only do they grab attention, but they help with retention. I can probably guarantee you some of the things that you remember from messages are not just the truths or not just the things that were spoken, but probably the illustration that was connected with it. And sometimes you remember a truth because of a story or an illustration or a parable. So many of the things that Jesus said, he used illustrations or stories with because he's taking truth and he's putting, in a sense, windows in it so that we can see it. And stories, they aid the memory and they help with the comprehension. They illustrate belief. And here he is telling a story, and he is sharing something that is helping them see what is going on. So the details of this story is that the trees want a king. The olive tree, the fig tree, and the vine all decline. And I don't think in this that Jotham or God is saying it was wrong for any person ever to become a king. But it's wrong to become unfruitful in one's calling. And they knew if we go to sway, we can't do that and also be the fruit-bearing trees that we've been called to be. Sometimes things are called to sway. There's other trees that, you know, that's what they do. And that's fine. But here they knew just the limitations of their calling. And then you have the bramble, who's presumptuous, and he's a spitfire. It's dangerous. One quote by a guy named Ralph Davis. He says, Jotham's theme is a foolishness and peril of accepting clearly unqualified leadership. Brambles make good fuel, but poor kings. They burn better than they reign. And we're going to see that Jotham's parable here ends up becoming really a prophecy. It literally comes to pass where there is a fire that destroys. So verses 22 through 41, we start to see the cracks in the kingdom. Verse 22. After Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. That's not even a very long period of time. He's got 3 years of getting to rule and reign, and the Shechemites have 3 years of experiencing what it's like to have a king, and then things start to fall apart. It says God sent a spirit of ill will. And what does this mean? That God sent a spirit of ill will. I don't think God has angels that live in heaven that intentionally come down and actually try to stir up problems and dissension. God's a God of unity, right? That's his character, it's harmony and unity. So how can he send a spirit of ill will? I think it relates to a story in 1 Kings 22. Jump over to 1 Kings 22. There's this story about Ahab. And he's the king of Israel in the north. And there's another king, Jehoshaphat, who is the king of Judah in the south. And they're friends. And so Jehoshaphat is up north, and Ahab's saying, I'm going to go out to battle. You want to come with me? And Jehoshaphat says, yes, I'd be glad to go out to battle with you. But he says, let's ask God first. Let's seek God's counsel and instruction. And so Ahab's a wicked man. He doesn't follow the Lord. He brings in all of his prophets. And who he's surrounded himself with is yes men. It's people who say whatever the king wants. So all these guys come in and they say, you're going to have victory. It's going to be raging success. Go out to battle. And Jehoshaphat sees through it all. And he says, let's ask a true prophet. And Ahab says, well, there's this one guy, Micaiah, but I don't like him. I hate him because he always says bad things. And Jehoshaphat says, don't say that. Go send for him. And so Micaiah comes and he's warned before he comes. Everybody else has said good things, hint, hint, say good things to the king. And so he comes, and he stands before the two kings, and Ahab says, should we go out to battle? And Micaiah says, yes, you should go out to battle. And Ahab says, tell me the truth. And then Micaiah, he was being sarcastic, and he says this. Verse 17, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each return to his house in peace. Does that sound like good news? No. Basically, the king's going to die if he goes out to battle. And the king of Israel, Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? Then Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by. and on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab to go up, that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead? So one spoke in this manner, and another spoke in that manner. It sounds like the angels are coming up with different ideas before God. And the Lord said to him, in what way? Oh, then a spirit, verse 21, came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. Now, it doesn't say that this was an angel. The Lord said, in what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all his prophets. And he said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Now, therefore, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours. And the Lord has declared disaster against you. Now, you look at that and you're thinking, well, God's a God of what? He's a God of truth. So how can he send a lying spirit? That's contradictory to his nature. But God is a God who's opposed to evil. And here, he's in a situation where he sees Ahab, and Ahab is determined to do what is evil and to do what is wrong. And there comes a point where God, in a sense, he steps aside and he removes his hand and he lets a person fall. And what does Ahab want to believe right now? He wants to believe a lie. And so God's saying, okay, I will let you believe a lie. But it's God sovereignly permitting the enemy, I believe, to come in and speak the lie. I don't think God spoke the lie, but God allowed the lie to be spoken. Just like here, God is allowing a spirit of ill will to be sent between Abimelech and Shechem. The enemy is causing division, and God's permitting it. Where God is sovereign, but he's stepping away, removing his restraining hand, and the enemy rushes in and is causing these things. But God is sovereignly overseeing it all. And so there is this contention, this division between Abimelech and the city of Shechem. And we're not told why, but I think the city of Shechem, they realized Abimelech's not really the king we were hoping he was going to be. There's a letdown because he can't be the savior and the hero that only God can be. So this is what the city does. God allowed it that the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be settled and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in the killing of his brothers. And the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along that way, and it was told Abimelech. So what they're doing, in a sense, is giving Abimelech a political black eye. This is the region he's ruling. It's a place where people are traveling through. And now, all of a sudden, it's not a safe place for people to travel. And so this is the area that Abimelech's in charge of. Be like, let's say it's the governor of Oregon. And you've got the I-5 corridor. And all of a sudden, there's all these robberies on I-5. People are being pulled over. People are having all this stuff happen. And if it's just going on for a long period of time, guess what? Who's going to get in trouble? The governor, right? He's going to have somebody calling him and saying, can you please stop this? And so here they are, in a subtle way, working against Abimelech. Verse 26. Now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brothers and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So now they shift their allegiance to another guy. And I think the only reason why they like this guy is because he's new. I don't think he's really much better than Abimelech when you start to read about him. So they went out into the fields and they gathered grapes from their vineyards and they trod them and made merry. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Wine's running, tongues are loosed, and hearts are spilling out. They don't like Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebal his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. but why should we serve him? So this new guy is speaking pompous words, and verse 28, from what I've read, is a very challenging verse for people to interpret. So if you read it in different translations, maybe you have a different translation and it's quite different from what I just read. Some people think the reason why verse 28 is so challenging to understand is because it's the words of a drunken man being spoken here. And so people don't always speak clearly. And so the person who's trying to gather it had a hard time putting and making sense, in a sense, of what was being spoken. So verse 29, he says, if only this people were under my hand, then I would remove Abimelech. So he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So he's challenging him to fight, but it's just an empty gesture because Abimelech's not there. But Abimelech's officer, or the ruler of the city, was there, and he heard, verse 30. When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was aroused, and he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, take note, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are, fortifying the city against you. Now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be, as soon as the sun is up in the morning, that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. As soon as he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as you find opportunity. So Zebul sends word to Abimelech. There's an uprising, come and squash it. So Abimelech and all his people who were with him rose by night, laying wait against Shechem in four companies. And when Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate, Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait. So he's just stretching that morning, rubs his eyes. He sees out in the fields people coming. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, look, people are coming down from the mountaintops. But Zebul said, you see the shadows of the mountains as if they were men. You're still a little bit, you know, recovering from the previous night. You're just seeing things. And Gaal spoke again and said, see, people are coming down from the center of the land. And another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree. And then Zebul turned to him and said, where indeed is your mouth now? With which you said, who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Are not these the people whom you despised? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now. So he said, you asked for a fight. Here's your opportunity. Be a man and go face him. And so Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him. And many fell wounded, even to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech dwelt in Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem. So Gaal has to flee, this new foreigner that Shechem had liked. And the men of Shechem were defeated with Gaal, but they're not killed. And they're probably waking up the next day hoping that it's all going to kind of pass away and, you know, nothing's going to happen out of it. But they have angered Abimelech. And so verse 42, it came to pass on the next day that the people went out into the field that they told Abimelech. So he took his company, divided them in three companies, and lay in wait in the field. And he looked, and there were the people coming out of the city to go work in the fields. And he attacked them and rose. Then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, and two other companies rushed upon all who were in the fields and killed them. So they cut off their way of escape. All the people who were outside the city had no shelter, no safety, and he wiped them all out. So Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he took the city, and he killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city and sowed it with salt, so that it was going to be infertile. Now when all the men of the tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold by the temple of the god Bereth. So there were some people that were able to escape, and they ran to this tower. And it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. Then Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand, and he cut a bough from the trees, and he took it, and he laid it on his shoulder. And then he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done." So he says, in a sense, follow the leader. Just copy what I'm doing. So they all grab a branch, and they walk back down to the tower. So each of the people likewise cut down his own bough and followed Abimelech and put them against the stronghold and set the stronghold on fire above them, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. And so you have here a man who's enraged against the city that he had originally been aligned with. And the city's destroyed now. All these people are dead. Abimelech thinks he's probably in the clear, but his anger is not abated. He's wiped out everybody who's guilty, but he thinks some other people are guilty as well. So verse 50, then Abimelech went to Thebez, which is the first mention of the city, and he encamped against it, and he took it. Now, it's close by, but there's no indication that they had been accomplices in the activity. So I think that they're innocent, but he's just carrying on his vengeance. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women and all the people of the city fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. Now, what had happened with the previous tower? Burned it down, right? So Abimelech, he's thinking, I'm just going to do the same thing. He came as far as the tower and he fought against it, and he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. So he's planning to do the same thing. But a certain woman, this sounds like it's random, but it's not. A certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. This, to me, is a little tiny bit of humor in the midst of a very sad, tragic story. Because the upper millstone is the equivalent of a KitchenAid, you know, a mixer, something that's helping you with baking. And here's this woman fleeing from her house, going to the tower, and what is she bringing? The KitchenAid. And I'm sure the husband is saying, leave that. We don't need it. And she's saying, you never know. We might need to be there for a while. She brings her KitchenAid with her into the tower and lugging it up the stairs. It's a stone. It's big. I don't think she probably ever intended and anticipated that it would be used for the purpose that she was going to use it for. You know, dropping the KitchenAid over the wall. That wasn't her thoughts, I don't think. But God used this. God worked it out for Abimelech's destruction. And he was hit by it, and it crushed his skull. Verse 54, then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed me. So his young man thrust him through, and he died. What has he been in pursuit of his entire life? Honor, 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 honor. And what happens to him? In his mind, it's the most shameful thing. I was killed by a woman. And he tries to rewrite history. He tries to kind of cover up the fact that he was killed by a lady. And so he has his servant kill him. But later in 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 21, there's another story of people getting close to a wall, and they talk about this story, and they say there's danger in getting too close to the wall. Remember how Abimelech was killed by a woman who threw a stone over the wall? And so he's not able to even successfully rewrite history so that people remember it differently. They know he died by a woman. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his own place. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father, by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Zerubbabel. So you have here Shechem's fall, you have here Abimelech's fall, and I think the irony is they brought about their own destruction. Shechem, what did they want? They wanted a king that would save them. And they pursued the wrong king, and that king destroyed them. The king they thought would save led about to their own ruin. And Abimelech, what did he want? He wanted self-honor so bad that he fought for it, one step too far, or many steps too far. And it was in his pursuit of preserving his honor that he brought about shame upon himself. And in all of this, the thing that they greatly feared came to pass, destruction and shame, because they had misplaced their hope. God destroyed evil here by letting evil destroy itself. There is within sin the seed for its own destruction. In a sense, what we have here is God steps back and they just devour one another. And I think in some sense, it's a picture of what eternity will be like. I don't picture God and the judgment of eternity for people who say no to God, of God holding a whip over hell, just constantly punishing them. I think it's God's hand of release saying, you want sin? I will release sin to yourself and I'll give you what you want. But what you want is going to destroy yourself. And so that's what takes place here in this story. One other thing that a person said about this story, Judges 9 teaches us something else very important. There is no fellowship in evil. Evil has no lasting cohesion. It does not care for its own. It only uses its own. One last point, and then we'll be done. Again, this is in the middle pretty much of the book. And when you think of Judges, especially for kids, it's not really a kid's book, but you sometimes hear of, you know, if you're a kid, you hear of Gideon, you hear of Samson. And you think of these people as heroes. And so you've got this house and hall of heroes, though they have feet of clay. They're very broken heroes. But it's a story of, in part, being heroic and stepping up in times of need. And here in this chapter, we have a boy who grew up wanting to be a hero, wanting true greatness. And it causes us to really consider the question, what is true greatness? In Matthew 20, Jesus' disciples, they sought greatness. His two disciples, James and John, had the desire in themselves. And they, like Abimelech, they don't want to ask the question themselves. They get somebody else to ask the question. They talk to their mom. Talk to Jesus. Can they sit at your right hand and your left? They're looking for positions of greatness, just like Abimelech. And Jesus said, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am able to drink, that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said to him, we are able, having no idea what they were talking about. So he said to them, you will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those whom it is prepared for by my Father. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. They're mad at them for seeking those positions. And why are the 10 disciples mad at the other two? Because they want those positions themselves. And they're like, I should have asked that. Or you're beating me to it. I'm wanting that position as well. And Jesus does not rebuke them for their desire for greatness. He said to them, he called them to himself. He sees this conflict. And he doesn't say, guys, stop it. You're not any of you getting those positions. He doesn't say that. He says, do you want to know what true greatness is? I'll tell you. It's not like the world, though. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. In other words, in the world, if you want greatness, you have to fight for it. You have to claw and hook your way there as much as you can, trampling over others sometimes. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. In other words, what Jesus is saying is the way up is first down. That there's a servanthood and a humility. And it's not that you won't ever receive greatness, but it's a different route. And I think it's important for us when we are going through this book to stop here in the middle and realize that the truth of the book of Judges and the truth of the Bible is that we cannot be a hero until we know that we need a hero. Until we see Jesus came to serve us. That we need to be rescued. We need to be saved. And after that, our true heroism is just walking in step with him. And sometimes that heroism, it's not going to be, it may be mundane in some things. I mean, think of the woman who brought her KitchenAid up to the tower. Making a meal day after day with that millstone. It's a mundane thing. And yet she was faithful. And God used her millstone in a way that she never anticipated. Now, I'm not saying that your KitchenAid is going to be used in some way like that down the road. But at the same time, there may be things that you're doing that are daily in your life right now that you do not see the impact of it in eternity and the outcome. And the last point, and then we're done. There's a truth that I think Abimelech failed to see or believe. Because he was, as I mentioned at the beginning, like Buddy Pine, the boy who wanted to be Incrediboy, who felt like he was an outsider, an outcast, failed to see that God adopts outcast sons. That the gospel is not about us fighting to get what we can out of life, but it's freely receiving the best inheritance one could ever hope for in life. Abimelech could have had the eternity, and he chose instead to trade it away for 3 short years that were wasted. And that's not something that we need to do. So I'm going to close in prayer, and then we'll end with a song. Lord, we thank you for this chapter. It is a very strange chapter in the Bible, but we thank you for its place. We thank you, Lord, that you are a God who is not against greatness, but you do know the secret of true greatness. And that we don't have to fight for it, but Lord, ultimately it's something that we receive from you, that you gift it to us as we walk with you. And we thank you, Lord, for our hero, for Jesus, who has not rejected us, who has accepted us and made us accepted in the Beloved. We thank you, Lord, for that. And I pray that you would help us to rest in that when we're longing for something in life, when we feel outcast, that we wouldn't resort to our own means, but that we would rest in you. So we thank you again for your word in this chapter tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.